Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger Podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, Editor-in-Chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode number 104, when researchers from the firm Recorded Future saw an offer on a dark web marketplace for documentation describing the operation of the U.S. military's Reaper drone, they thought it must be a ruse, but they were wrong. We'll talk with Recorded Future researcher Andrei Borisovich about how this highly sensitive military drone documentation fell into the hands of a low-level cybercriminal. But first...
Because of what your superiors are making you do. This morning they are forcing you to attempt the impossible.
Is that Tokyo Rose?
Brothers?
Yeah, I guess so.
The impossible.
And no action.
For it is impossible for you to dislodge our forces on Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima? He's got a straight dope.
I'm filled with sadness for you.
75 years ago, radio was the communications medium of choice, and disinformation campaigns sounded a lot like the infamous Tokyo Rose, who broadcast messages to thousands of U.S. troops in the Pacific Theater during World War II, telling them that their cause was lost and unjust, and urging them to give up the fight against Japan. These days, of course, the internet is the medium that global communications depends on, and it's the first stop for nations that want to exert ideological influence over their adversaries. Just how far they might go to do so was the subject of an almost 30-page indictment of 12 Russian officers that was handed down in U.S. federal court last week by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. The indictment provides one of the most detailed looks yet inside a nation-state hacking campaign. As such, it's a goldmine of information about how sophisticated or just valuable organizations might be targeted. What are the key takeaways from the Mueller indictment? We here at Security Ledger read the whole thing so that you wouldn't have to, and here are some key takeaways that every information security professional should know. First, on the internet, Robert Mueller definitely knows that you're a dog. Anonymity was the original killer app of the internet, so to speak, but last week's indictment by Mr. Mueller and his team make clear that piercing the internet's veil of anonymity is hard but not impossible. The biggest takeaway by far from reading the whole 30-page, 11-count indictment is just how much Mr. Mueller and his team have reconstructed about the Russian online influence campaign, as well as the impressive amount of information they have on the individuals who helped carry it out. The indictment rolls out not just the identities, titles, and roles of these individuals, but the tools, tactics, and processes they used in minute detail. It describes the roles that 12 named Russian operatives played in the conspiracy to disrupt the U.S. election, and accounts of specific actions they performed down to the exact day and time of day that they performed them. In one of the most impressive reveals of the indictment, Mueller's team is able to link searches for English language phrases conducted via a Moscow-based server operated by the Russian GRU intelligence agency during a 40-minute window on June 15th, 2016. Those exact same phrases appear in a blog entry posted by the Guccifer 2.0 personality later that day as part of the leak of stolen Democratic Party documents. The inevitable conclusion of this is that while the internet makes it easy to scatter digital breadcrumbs far and wide, using fake email accounts, rented or compromised servers in foreign countries, and bogus social media accounts, it also makes it possible for an astute and careful detective to slowly identify and collect those very same breadcrumbs, piece them together, and discern a trail back to you, whoever you are and wherever you are in the world. For cybercriminals and nation-state hackers, that's sobering news indeed. The next big takeaway, three words, time to detection. It's common for information security vendors these days to throw around terms like threat intelligence, TTPs, and time to detection. It all ends up sounding like just a bunch of marketing gobbledygook. But if you read the Mueller indictment closely, you'll realize that it's anything but. The cyber failings of the Clinton campaign and Democratic Party are well documented at this point. There was lackluster security. They didn't use strong second factors to secure access to critical accounts, and their incident response was sleepy, to say the least. And yes, the Dems were being targeted by a nation-state actor who was resourceful and determined. Sure, compromise of some sort was a foregone conclusion. But time and again, the Mueller indictment makes clear that the Clinton campaign, as well as the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and others who were targeted, were graced with a window of time, often measured in days, between the initial compromise of their systems and the beginning of malicious hacking and data exfiltration by the Russian actors. We learn, for example, that 6 full days passed between the initial theft of login credentials from a Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee staffer via a phishing attack, and the initial use of those same credentials to access a DCCC network. In another instance, the GRU operatives had a period of about a week to compromise the Democratic National Committee's exchange server and steal tens of thousands of emails. In all, Russian operatives had access to their target networks for a period measured in months, even after the campaign and Democratic Party organizations became aware of the attacks and brought in professionals to clean up the mess. Early detection of the initial incursions onto these networks and systems would have greatly limited the damage caused. There's absolutely no doubt. Time to detection is key. Finally, those who live by Bitcoin die by Bitcoin. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have become the coins of the realm for cybercriminals, money launderers, and others who wish to cover their tracks and money trails for whatever reason. Cryptocurrencies and the blockchain distributed ledger that undergirds them create something close to digital cash, mostly anonymous and also transparent exchanges that are written immutably to a digital ledger. The problem with cryptocurrencies is that while their transparency is mathematically guaranteed, their anonymity isn't. We see this in the Mueller indictment, which describes how investigators were able to pierce the veil of anonymity around the Bitcoin accounts used to pay for various aspects of the online Russian disinformation campaign by connecting disposable email accounts to the conspirators, as well as to the IT systems used to carry out transactions, and in some cases, even mine cryptocurrencies that were then used to fund the campaign. Far from obscuring the active measures campaign, Bitcoin and the web of mining and blockchain transactions that took place became a kind of map for prosecutors to recreate the actions and expenditures of the Russian GRU operatives throughout the campaign. So what do we take away from the Mueller indictment? For IT pros, the lesson seems simple enough. Phishing and social engineering attacks are cheap and plentiful. They also work. Online infrastructure is easily provisioned and deployed to further fast-evolving and flexible attacks. Cryptocurrencies make it possible to fund these programs in a seemingly anonymous and untraceable way. But in the end, the Mueller indictment suggests that there's nothing magical about cyber operations compared to, say, kinetic operations or human intelligence operations. True, the fingerprints that they leave may be harder to read and easier to laugh away and deny, but they're still there. That's useful information for both predator and prey to keep in mind. Up next, how did the operation manual and other sensitive documentation for the U.S. military's prized Reaper drone end up for sale on an underground marketplace for the paltry sum of $200? Our next guest, Andrei Borisovich of the firm Recorded Future, says that the culprit is an all-too-common one, an insecure broadband router belonging to an Air Force officer. In this conversation, Andre and I talk about how his firm stumbled on the documentation, what they learned about the person who was fencing them, and what the implications of the find are for the military, the government, and private sector firms who want to protect valuable information and keep it out of the hands of cyber criminals. I started by asking Andre to talk about how Recorded Future researchers first came upon the Reaper drone documents.
My name is Andre Borisovich, and I'm director of advanced collection at Recorded Future. Paul, it's a very peculiar case because in almost 15 years that I've been researching deep and dark web communities, it is the first time I found documents which were stolen from military agency of this magnitude. And what's striking is that these documents were actually put for sale for very, very cheap. So it actually means that an actor who stole them had no idea how valuable the information is and where to sell it, and he would probably buy them. So in early June, we identified an actor, an English-speaking actor who was posting the information on one of the English-speaking underground communities, saying that he has access to the U.S. Air Force information. Initially, he said that he compromised the computer of a U.S. Air Force captain, and he stole a lot of his personal documents, which were maintenance documents for MQ-9A Reaper drone. And I'm sure you know that Reaper drone is probably one of the most advanced technologies that our armed forces currently use pretty much everywhere in the world. Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, it's used to secure our borders. It's in Europe. So it's incredibly advanced military technology. And when we ask this actor to share more information and to tell us and to share and to actually show us what exactly he has, he sent us some screenshots at first, and we saw that it was, although it was not a classified information, it was still very, very sensitive. If you can see on our blog, on one of the images, it actually says that the information should not be distributed with anyone except DOD, Department of Defense, and its contractors only. So we've immediately realized that we're dealing with a very, very significant security breach. So we've asked him to give us even more information. And since this actor was fairly new to the community, he was only active for a couple of weeks, he probably didn't know how things work in the criminal forums, and he was very, very open to our surprise. So he actually shared even more information, including the name of a captain whose computer was compromised.
Kind of boasting or bragging a little bit, I guess.
I would say so, yeah. We've actually kept an open channel of communication with him for several weeks, and we built a rapport. And he actually shared with us his method. He explained how he was able to identify this particular individual. And believe it or not, it was not a targeted attack. It was by pure accident that he stumbled upon Captain's computer. So what he does is he's using widely available and quite popular Shodan internet search. So it's a search engine very similar to Google or Yahoo. However, it searches for Internet of Things devices which are exposed on the internet. So if you know how to form a proper request, you can actually specify what exactly you're looking for. So in our case, he knew that certain models of Netgear routers were exposed to outside intrusions, meaning that if, for example, you own an Netgear router, you can activate a feature which is called FTP, which allows you to access your files on your computer or even on a thumb drive, which you can quite often connect directly to your router remotely. And it's a good feature. A lot of people use it pretty much on a day-to-day basis, but it's a horrible feature if you don't know how to properly secure it. So you see, the problem is, by default, when you activate the feature, the standard login credentials for the FTP option would be admin and password. And bad guys know about that. And simply by searching for routers that have FTP feature activated with standard login credentials, they could find thousands upon thousands of exposed routers. And this is exactly what this criminal did. And it's actually not a single criminal. We believe it's a group of hackers working together. So what they would do is they would scan the entire internet every day, day in, day out. They would identify victims and then log in into victims' computers to see what's exactly there, what's available. On one day, he was able to steal the data from a cryptocurrency company. On the other day, it was a law firm. Some other day, it was a financial company. However, in early June, he stumbled upon Captain's computer, U.S. Air Force Captain's computer, and he found information about the U.S. military drone. So,
it's on the one hand, it's shocking. And on the other hand, it's completely unsurprising. I mean, what you describe is, you know, sort of the basic blocking and tackling of cyber criminals these days, you know, kind of scan, use tools like Shodan to scan for vulnerable machines, poke around, see if you can get into them and see what's there. It's just that what he seems to have come upon is obviously highly sensitive information.
In this respect, it's actually not much different from criminals, say, 5-10 years ago, dumpster diving, right? They would just go through people's garbage to see if somebody threw away, let's say, bank checks, right? Or bank statements. So it's pretty much the same attack vector. However, this time they do it on the internet. They just spend more time on searching and they're more dedicated with what they do.
Hey, this is Paul Roberts of the Security Ledger. If your company's trying to reach sophisticated information technology professionals with an interest in information security, consider becoming a Security Ledger podcast sponsor. Each month, thousands of IT professionals download our podcast to hear in-depth reporting and interviews with some of the sharpest minds in information security. To find out more about sponsoring the Security Ledger podcast, go to our webpage, securityledger.com/sponsor. I guess what's one of the things that's interesting to me here is just the connection between these, you know, insecure home routers, Soho routers, and the leaking of a highly sensitive document. I mean, it's really easy to see how it could happen, but it really does reinforce this kind of weakest link nature of cybersecurity that, you know, an organization like the Air Force is only as secure as the least secure router of one of its Air Force men or women with classified clearance.
Exactly. And I feel that the problem is even bigger than what it seems from right now. The thing is, FTP allows you to upload any files as well as download them. So if you can imagine, this is someone who probably has access to classified information. We know that most likely he was using his own personal computer to access documents because from what we researched and from what we know so far, it's very unlikely that US Air Force would have used exposed routers on their bases, right? However, if this person was using his own personal computer to access sensitive documents, and he could have been also exposed to an attack, meaning a malware could have been planted on his computer. A bad guy could have monitored his online activities to intercept his login credentials to his military systems. So the issue is much bigger. And I would say that we actually got unlucky that we spotted him. It was actually a good thing that a hacker decided to post this information on the forum and we were able to spot it in time and alert authorities. But it's the same problem, but however, a more determined adversary, let's say nation state attacker, right? They could have been running this Shodan scans on 24/7 basis, and he could have been exposed several months before that time. And who knows how far and how deep that adversary could have moved inside the network and what damage could have been done. So although it's highly disturbing, but it's as funny as it sounds, it's actually a good thing that we found this information.
You said that you were able to have an ongoing conversation with this individual for a couple of weeks, you know, both before and after he had transmitted these documents to Recorded Future, kind of prove that he had what he said he had. What did you learn about him or her and any sense of who they are, where they are in the world, what their motivations are?
Right. So we're 100% certain that they, well, there's no such thing as 100% certain. I would say 99% certain that the group is financially motivated. They're not working for any of the foreign governments. They're not part of intelligence operation. However, they steal information for money, right? That's the sole goal, is to find valuable information and then sell it on the internet. We also learned that at least several of its members are residing in one of the South American countries. We are, I would say, very confident that we know at least several real names of these hackers. Although at the moment we can't share this information because the investigation is still ongoing. Obviously, we shared it with the law enforcement, though.
And you said you learned the name of the captain whose home machine was compromised, divulged his documents. Were you able to, or was the Air Force able to follow up with that individual and maybe see if there had been previous contacts or other information leaked?
Whenever you're dealing with the law enforcement or the government, it's for the most part one-way street. You send the information, but you rarely get any response back.
They say, thank you. Thank you very much.
Right. So that's one of the cases. We do know that Captain was briefed and then it was confirmed that his system indeed was compromised. But beyond that, we have no further information.
What do you think? I mean, if you're the U.S. military, the U.S. Air Force, or the U.S. military more broadly, gosh, how do you prevent incidents like this? On the one hand, you can do training, and I guess maybe you can have software to manage data flows so that sensitive information doesn't leave the premises, but that's very hard to do. Do you need to get in the business of securing your soldiers' home networks as well? Or, I mean, how do you even deal with this?
It seems there's going to be a very hard thing to balance because now we're dealing with invasion of privacy. And although I like your idea, I think that as long as you have access to sensitive information and you work for the government, you should allow professionals to set up your own systems to make sure that your Wi-Fi is not exposed, make sure that your routers are not exposed, that you have valid and up-to-date antivirus system installed, and in general, your operational system on your computer is up-to-date. That would be an amazing step, and I think it would have solved a lot of our problems. And then you also have certain policies and procedures in place that will prevent any information from leaving, you know, premises of the base and being used on the home machines, because I can see why this information was used on his personal machine. It's not classified information. It is sensitive, but it's not classified. And most likely, this particular captain never thought that he would be a target of a hacker. So he didn't see why the information, what damage could have been, you know, could be done if the information is lost. So training is the must, and continuous training is the must. And what I also think is a lot of our military personnel are given a very thorough cybersecurity courses, but no one explains security one-on-one steps, as I just mentioned, you know, how to properly secure your Wi-Fi router, how to secure your computer in general, and just explain, you know, in plain language what damage could be done if a hacker gets access to their information and how hackers find information. A lot of people think that hackers perform only targeted attacks. In my experience, I would say that 99% of all attacks happen by accident. It's quite rare to see when a hacker knows his target and he actively pursues this target. Well, probably only if we're dealing with nation-state attackers. But criminal hackers rarely go after a particular victim. They basically do a widespread attack, widespread network, right, on that, and then just see, and then just
see what they catch, right? See what gets caught in the net.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're opportunistic.
Of course.
Yeah. So you said, obviously, these weren't the designs for the G4 drone that wouldn't allow somebody who had them to start making their own military drones. It was an operator's manual. What risk does it pose to the drones that are in the sky?
I'm not a drone specialist to ascertain exact level of information in these manuals, but it seems to me that it might not be able, you know, criminals or whoever has access, if we assume somebody else has access to this information, it's very unlikely they'll be able to replicate or build a drone of their own, right? But they might be able to find vulnerable systems, right? Electrical systems, navigational systems, optics, and it's a very, very extensive manual which is used to train the maintenance crew for Reaper drone. So I would think that at the very least adversaries would be able to figure out how to spot vulnerabilities in the design itself. If I'm not mistaken, last year or maybe 2 years ago, there was an incident when a foreign nation was able to take control of one of our drones in the sky. So I would hate to see this happening again.
Okay. So what's your recommendation or what is your advice to security conscious organizations out there? They can't barge, especially if they're private companies, right? They can't barge into their employees' living rooms and demand to see the configuration of their home routers. I'm not even sure the military can do that. So what should they do?
Clear guidance. You know, there should be very, very clear procedures in place preventing employees from taking any official documents home. They should not be able to log in to their own home computer or even work computers remotely unless they're using secure channels like SFTPs, for example, with very strong encryption protocols and secured by strong passwords and usernames. So it's, I would say it's a procedural issue. And then obviously trainings, ongoing training, and companies should actually, and organizations in general, they should be paying attention to cybersecurity issues all the time. It shouldn't be just a mark on a form that someone completed his cyber training once a year. People really have to understand why they do that. Because a simple mistake by one employee could cost a business to the entire organization.
Andre, is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't?
We could have actually went even deeper. The same hacker, not only he stole the information from the US Air Force, but he replicated the attack and he stole information from Pentagon official, right? So he was able to obtain maintenance documents for Abrams tank. He also stole documents outlining our mitigation tactics, improvised explosive devices, the same training materials we have in place for our army personnel in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, now could have been leaked to a terrorist organizations. And then they would be able to, if purchased by terrorist groups, right, they would be able to learn from everything that we know and potentially risk lives of or put in jeopardy lives of army personnel overseas.
This is all from the same compromise system.
We believe it was a different system. However, it was performed by the same hacking group.
And you say this is all more or less inadvertent, that they were looking for information to sell, but not necessarily targeting military personnel or military data.
From what we've seen so far, yes, that was not a direct attack. I would say in the past 2.5 months, the same criminal group targeted at least 25, 30 different organizations. They've been releasing new information pretty much on a daily basis. And only twice the information was stolen from US military.
Do we have any reason to believe the military is taking steps to address this risk or prevent future incidents like this? I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of soldiers and airmen and women. That's a lot of endpoints, especially when you then look at their families and so on.
We have to be realistic. I don't think we'll ever be able to secure everyone's system, everyone's computer, and prevent data theft entirely. But we can do our best, and I'm sure that military will learn from this particular incident once they fully understand what happened, how it happened, and the full extent of the breach. And I'm sure that certain changes will be made in the internal procedures.
I mean, it's difficult. These people have jobs. Some of these documents, I'm sure they're taking home and reading as part of just trying to do their job and be informed and prepared, right? And you don't want to discourage that. But it does, once they leave that protected Air Force network environment, they are vulnerable.
Indeed, they are. I don't think we'll find, or the Air Force will ever find, a single solution to this problem. I'm sure we'll have and we'll see more stories like this in the future. We'll do our best to help them if our help is needed. If we ever spot anything similar, we're obviously going to alert the law enforcement and the army, and we continue monitoring the same criminal group. So hopefully, eventually, this group will be apprehended by the law enforcement and there'll be another chapter of our life.
How does Recorded Future maintain its presence on these underground networks now that you've come public with what you know? That obviously is going to expose the persona that you use to interact with this individual. How do you maintain persistence within these groups after you've come public with what you found?
It's always a mix and match. So in certain cases, we never go public because the access level that we have is too valuable and we we are unwilling to lose it. Sometimes we have backup access in place. So sometimes we can afford to lose and burn our credentials and our aliases. So this one of the cases when we were ready and prepared to pretty much burn the entire person identity, yes.
Mm-hmm. Andre Barsovich, thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast and talking to us about this really interesting discovery you guys made out on the dark web of sensitive military documents.
Thank you, Paul. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.